Welcome to Talking Brains. I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Sarkis. You may recognize this episode's guest, Dr. Seth Gillihan, from a previous Talking Brains episode on malevolence OCD. It's one of our most popular episodes, so I encourage you to check it out. Today we'll be talking about cognitive behavioral therapy strategies you can use, specifically when you encounter difficult people. Seth Gillihan, PhD, is a licensed psychologist and clinical assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of several books, including Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Made Simple, 10 Strategies for Managing Anxiety, Depression, Anger, Panic, and Worry. He's also the creator of the CBT Deck, 101 Practices to Improve Thoughts. He's also the host of the podcast Think, Act, Be, and he's a fellow blogger at Psychology Today. He has a private practice in Haverford, Pennsylvania, and also sees clients by video conference. Seth's website is sethgillihan.com. That's SETHGILLIHAN.com. Enjoy the podcast. This is Dr. Seth Gillihan, and he's been on the podcast before talking about malevolence OCD, and that's one of the highest rated podcast episodes, so I encourage you to check that out. And we're going to talk today about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy with difficult people. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a style of therapy or type of therapy that has the most research backing up as a empirically proven way to help treat anxiety, depression, ADHD. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And Dr. Gillihan has the Think, Act, Be podcast. And also his cards incorporate Think, Act, Be. He's got this new card deck. It's CBT cards that you can carry around with you. You can take them to work. Take them to wherever you're at, and you can pick one up and read about a CBT. I would say probably tenant is a good word for it. So, and it's interesting. I was flipping through this deck, and I found there are ones that just applied to whatever issue was coming up that day. So we're going to talk a little bit about that later. But first, we're going to talk about difficult people and how you can practice some cognitive behavioral techniques when you're working with difficult people, or they're in your family, or friendship, neighbors. You know, we've all got people that we interact with in our lives that are kind of hard to figure out, or we tend to get riled up by them and we're not really sure why sometimes. So I'm just going to go ahead and call you Seth. So Seth, tell me a little bit about how CBT can help when you're dealing with someone that is maybe cantankerous, or you have ideological differences with them and you have to have contact with this person.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with you about this, Stephanie, because obviously you deal with a lot of people who are, well, you work with a lot of people who are dealing with difficult people, right? In your work, obviously one of your areas of expertise is gaslighting, mm-hmm. which, I mean, I don't know if there's many more difficult types of persons than a gaslighter. So I'm looking forward to thinking about these things with you. But, you know, as I was thinking about this topic, kind of leading up to our discussion, I was thinking, I mean, there are, I guess, well, two major ways we might think about using CBT. One is working on ourselves. The other is trying to kind of change the relationship in some way. I don't know if we can actually change the other person, how successfully mm-hmm. we could do that. But you know, if we're working directly on ourselves, I think of three main approaches, and they're, you know, they're not coincidentally, they're the ones that are captured in Think, Act, Be. So we can, you know, look at the kinds of thoughts that we have about the person and the relationship, and maybe they're exactly right and there's nothing we need to change, or maybe they're biased or distorted in some way, and changing those might be helpful. There are our actions, things that we do toward the person, or things that we do to just maybe deal with stress, or controlling our schedule around in our contact with the person. So we can certainly address the behavioral part of CBT. And then, you know, the more mindfulness-based approaches. And you know, as I thought more about this, these may be especially relevant in working with difficult people. So, you know, working on practices around acceptance and, you know, opening to reality as it is. And accepting doesn't necessarily mean just accepting that we're going to, you know, be around a difficult person and suffer for it, but accepting that things are the way they are, and then we can act based on that. So I think those are, maybe that's kind of a broad framework, then we can think about more specifics.
So would you say if you are interacting with someone that you know in the past that you just don't get along, because sometimes we click with people and sometimes we don't, and let's say that person's a coworker, because I run into that a lot. There are a lot of coworkers that just tend to just, you don't choose to be with them. You are kind of just put next to them in your cubicle. And what would be a, let's say a non-CBT thought that you would have if your coworker is constantly kind of just picking at you and just saying little things to you like, oh, I think that report could be better or something like that? Because there are people that just tend to think that they know how to fix everybody's stuff. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, some, I think, you know, some version of, you know, why is this person so difficult? Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out an answer to that. Mm-hmm. So some, you know, thought process that's, you know, maybe similar to worry in a way, and that it goes around and around and never resolves. Mm-hmm. But it's that it's kind of captured in that feeling of, I can't believe this person is so difficult. Why are they so difficult? Is it something about me? Is it something about them? Is it something I'm doing? And going around and around.
And how would be a way that someone could change their beliefs about that? Because again, like you said, that's like worry. It's like being in a rocking chair. You know, you do stuff, but it doesn't get you anywhere.
Right.
So,
you know, I actually used I had to use a kind of CBT approach with, actually, it was someone who works in the CBT field, to be honest.
Not me, by the way.
It was not Stephanie Sarkis.
That's right. Although after the podcast, you might need to. I don't know.
We'll see. I've done this before, and it was a nice experience.
Oh, good.
So,
okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm optimistic.
Thank you for validating.
Yes. But yeah, I kept having that feeling. I get into these, you know, fights in my head. Like I would, you know, imagine future conversations with this person, or think back on ones we'd already had and think, oh, I can't believe they said that, and I should have said this. And if we talk about it again and they say that, I'll say this. And, you know, over and over. And meanwhile, you know, there I am, you know, spending time with my kids, or at least, you know, I'm there physically, but maybe not mentally, or I'm, you know, chopping vegetables for dinner. But it's really like the scene never changes, because I'm just continually in my head about it. And where I finally found freedom from it was just kind of accepting, like, oh, this person's just difficult. Mm-hmm. They're a difficult person. Of course, they're being impossible to deal with, because that's exactly who they are. Why would I expect them to be any different? They've proven that over and over, and everyone that I've talked to who knows them knows exactly what to expect. And so there was that it was a kind of mindful acceptance, like, oh, that's who this person is. And then when I would get into those, you know, I'd start asking myself the question of, like, I can't believe they did that. I'd say, like, well, what else would they do? And from there, then I could make a decision about what I was going to do. And I mean, the acceptance itself I found really helpful, because I could get out of that mental back and forth, that kind of tug of war in my head. And God, what a lot of wasted time, you know, getting into mental fights with someone. And I eventually chose to move on. I didn't have to work in that environment anymore. So again, just to underscore that mindful acceptance doesn't mean you just sit there and take it. It might mean, all right, I accept this is how things are. I'm out of here.
Right. And I tell people, you know, this person isn't paying rent in your head. Mm-mm. So when they take up all that space, and how about someone?
I like that.
Yeah, because it really puts into perspective how much time you're going to spend this person. Because the chances are they're not spending as much time thinking about your issues if they're difficult.
100%. I don't know this for a fact, but I always have the sense that the more difficult person is thinking a lot less about the less difficult person.
Right. And I think also, especially when you're a helping profession, we tend to analyze. So I think that's a pretty normal thing for us to go to. Well, why is this person doing something? Or even looking at, well, did I do something to cause it? And you're saying, no, that sometimes people are just difficult and it doesn't really matter how they got there. It's just, that's kind of irrelevant sort of to the situation, if you will.
Right. Yes.
So what would you say to people that just tend to do the analyzing, or let's say they have a job where they get paid to analyze, and so that's their thinking process? How do you stop that natural inclination? You just talked about a little bit more, but how about if you aren't in a mental health field and you tend to analyze as part of your work? So you, in one way, you get a positive benefit from analyzing because you make a career from it. But how do you stop yourself doing that when it's a personal issue?
Yeah, great question. Because you're right. If you're trained, if you're rewarded in a good way throughout the day for doing that kind of process, then, I think the first thing is to recognize the difference between productive and unproductive analysis, and maybe there will be times where it's useful to think about why is this person doing this, and if they're not chronically difficult, maybe that's worthwhile. If our spouse was cranky that morning, rather than assuming the worst about them, we might say why were they doing that this morning? Oh, because they were up with the kids last night. Maybe they're a little sleep deprived or whatever. But I think it's important to keep in mind that stopping thoughts is nearly impossible. To say like, okay, stop having that mental argument with that person. So really, we have to redirect our attention in some way. So I encourage a person, first of all, to reframe with acceptance, to say like, as I was saying before, that's who this person is, and then to find something real, something concrete to turn their attention to. So for me, I remember one time I was chopping vegetables, and I love to cook. It's one of my favorite times of the day, and I wasn't getting much enjoyment out of it because I was feeling so tense and bound up with this fight at work. And so when I acknowledged that I didn't need to solve that in my head, I was able to come back and actually be with the knife as it moved through the vegetables and the aromas as things sauteed. And so, find something that's real in your world to put your focus on.
I think that brings up a really good point, that mindfulness could be something as simple as you're chopping vegetables or you're washing dishes. If you could talk a little bit about how you can incorporate mindfulness, because I think when we think about mindfulness, I think we tend to think of meditation.
Right.
Where you traditionally think of someone sitting or laying down while they do it, which isn't necessarily the case. But with mindfulness, the idea is that you can do mindfulness practices while you're busy doing things. So if you could explain a little bit about how that helps, that mindfulness, and how you can turn regular everyday activities into mindfulness.
Right. Well, any activity can be done mindfully. It just means that we're actually doing what we're doing and that we're opening to the experience of it, so we're allowing it to be as it is, rather than wishing it were some way different or resisting it in some way, saying like it shouldn't be this way. So, an example might be I'm walking in the rain and I'm just feeling bitter and miserable and somehow taking it personally that it's raining on me and it's my walk and I didn't bring an umbrella today and this isn't fair, and rather than sticking with those judgments, a mindful response might be to actually feel the rain. Like, what does the actual rain feel like? The actual physical sensations of what's happening when we're getting rained on, a lot of the time, aren't that bad. You're getting wet. Like, it's not worse than that. And so we can feel what's happening and then stop the fight. Most of our suffering is caused by resisting what's happening, not from the thing that's happening itself. So we're suffering much more from railing against the rain than we are from the drops that are landing on us.
Right. And then we can have these serendipitous moments when we let ourselves just experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And whatever it is, it can be a person in front of us, if it's maybe a little easier with someone who's easy to love, but really taking that person in. So, if you have kids and you're used to seeing them every day and you kind of, you have a feeling of, I know who my child is, sort of think intuitively or implicitly, I don't feel like there's a lot that's new here to see, but we can step back and if we act as though we're seeing the person for the first time, this is maybe a bit morbid, but if you imagine if you were leaving this earth and this was one of the last times that you were going to lay eyes on this person, like what would you notice about them? In that, like you alluded to, these ordinary experiences in our life, most mundane things can really become extraordinary.
Right. And those are the things we really remember too, I think. Little snapshots in time. And I'm going to throw a little CBT plus solution focused in there and say, there's this concept in solution focus, which is you change one thing, you change everything.
Yeah.
So the idea that you can start changing your interactions with people. So instead of a topic that's a hot button topic that you have a conflict about, maybe just listen to the person and and again, where they're coming from, and looking at that this stuff is not personal. Very rarely in life are things personal.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Although if you're like me, you take almost everything personally.
And I think that's a good point that you specialize in mental health and you tend to do that, because I think that's a common misconception that if you are a mental health professional, that you have your entire act together. So I mean, we have anxieties just like everyone else. And yeah. I think that's very freeing to be open about that we do tend to have the same issues that we try to help people with. And that's okay. But that's tricky to not think that something's personal, especially when someone's behaving, it appears to you like that person's behaving that way just towards you. But
right.
Rarely is that actually the case.
No, I'd be amazed if someone were extremely difficult toward you and not toward a lot of other people. And I really appreciated what you said, though, about, you know, we're humans just like mm-hmm. everyone else. It actually took me, I think, quite a while in my professional life to, you know, be willing to acknowledge my own struggles and limitations. But it has been so freeing. And also, you know, having similar struggles can be so useful in working with mm-hmm. someone, you know, because if you don't really know what chronic insomnia is like, it's mm-hmm. easy, you know, to give kind of pat answers about, you know, well, you know, just do this, or this is what the CBTI manual says. But when you've, you know, been down in there and you know, as closely as you can, exactly what the other person is going through, then, I think it makes you just much more effective.
Right. And that's not to say if you don't experience something that you can't be a good therapist. Because I don't want to give that impression either. But I think when you've walked the walk, I think it makes a big difference. Because you can tell, for instance, with chronic insomnia, it's a great example. You get to the point where you're so tired, it's very hard to think clearly. And it's even harder to apply these CBT techniques when that happens. And I think that, if you've been there, you understand that there's a difference between telling someone, hey, this is a good idea to do it, and the actual implementation and how user-friendly it is at that point in time. So that brings up a really excellent point.
Mm-hmm. So yes, it's the same with depression. Mm-hmm. You know, you tell someone, well, you need to be more active and do things that bring you reward. And, and you know, until I'd really been in a major depressive episode, mm-hmm. I mean, I think I knew the right words, but I don't think I had the right, I don't know. Again, like you said, you don't have to have experienced it to be effective, to be helpful. Right. But it is, it's just a different level when you know kind of the spirit mm-hmm. from which you're addressing something.
Now that we're talking about personal stuff, you could just give me an example of what's maybe a CBT technique that you used in the last week.
Oh boy, I could probably think of one in the last
last hour.
Actually, you know, it's a it's funny because I feel a little I don't know, self-conscious acknowledging this, but I'm actually going through the CBT deck myself, one card per day, mm-hmm. just to see what it's like. This totally just sounded like a plug for, but it's actually
no,
true.
That's okay. No, I think it's fascinating that you're going through your own deck, and we'll talk about what that's like. Yeah.
But, okay. I mean, if it were a book I'd written, I think that would be a little weirder, you know, because it's like me talking to me.
Right.
But with this, you know, the cards they're relatively brief, and really I just think of them as reminders that all of us can use. So, you know, the first four cards that I've drawn since I started doing this have been a nice opportunity to use some of these things myself. So the one that I'm using for today, I can share that one. That is called, I've got it right here, hands-free waiting. So the idea is whenever you're waiting for something and when you pay attention, it turns out you're waiting fairly often, rather than kind of reflexively taking out phones, usually our go-to, just take in the situation. Look around you, see what you notice, maybe notice how you're feeling internally, maybe see the people around you. And it's quite a different experience to sort of see what we may miss when we just habitually are filling all the gaps in our lives with a screen.
And that's particularly a good one for me too, because I tend to do that too. I tend to pick up the I check my email, and that's not very mindful. So especially when you realize that you're maybe not picking up on something somebody's saying or paying attention to your environment, So I feel like that really speaks to me as well. And you have 101 cards in this deck, and I think that's pretty remarkable that there are that many CBT concepts that are very individual yet all tie together. And what do you think is a card that is particularly salient right now for people, maybe? And also, what's one that you feel like people may not really know about CBT? Because there's concepts that we know from, reading online what CBT is, but what's one that someone may not think is connected to CBT? So I just asked you two different questions, but.
Oh, sure. Well, let me start with maybe I can give you an idea about one that may be useful for dealing with difficult people as well. This one I call Breathe with a Problem. So most of the B cards, the ones that come out of a mindfulness approach, are not actually meditation focused. They are about just being in your experience just as it is, like the hands-free waiting one. This one is more of a meditation. So you sit with your eyes closed and you bring to mind an unresolved problem. So something that triggers a moderate amount of challenging emotions. So it could be that relationship with a difficult coworker. And then as you think about it, you just notice how the emotion shows up. Like, does it manifest as physical tension? Do you feel mental strain? Do you feel a kind of sinking sensation in your spirit? And then you just spend a few minutes breathing with whatever you find. You don't try to change the feeling. You just allow it to be there and breathe. And what tends to happen as you sit with something is the feelings kind of shift and evolve on their own, and often will kind of dissipate if we don't fight against them or don't feed them. And then I just close with the invitation to practice making space for all of your experience.
Explain more about what that means to make space.
Yeah, well, so much of our lives we're pushing things away. That's not me. That's not for me. I don't like that. I reject that. And it tends to keep us in a sort of combat mode where we're constantly on the lookout for things that are against us. So it's more about shifting to more of an openness to things as they are, because again, when you think about this as your life and what it even is to have been chosen in a way to participate in this life, it's amazing how much of it we say no, no, no to, rather than, a friend of mine who actually died suddenly a couple of years ago, but he once said, and this stuck with me, said, he was quoting someone, I forget who wrote it, but he said, life is a gift horse. And this was after my friend had gone through a tragedy in his own life. And I thought, wow, that's really something to say, especially, he was facing having just he and his wife just had a stillborn baby.
Oh no. Oh
Yeah.
no. Oh. Wow, that's really profound.
I know. That must have been a good 10 years ago, but you can see it really stayed with me.
But it sounds like it was like yesterday.
Yeah, it really was. I
Yeah.
remember the scene. I remember the people gathered there.
Yeah. Huh. Wow, that really talks about just the human power resiliency too. And
Yeah.
wow, yeah, that's I feel like talking about other CBT concepts is kind of a minute thing right now because that's pretty amazing.
Well, I appreciate your saying that because I think CBT has a reputation for being kind of thin, or superficial, kind of like, we're gonna tinker with your thoughts, or we're gonna make you do like, try do a little of this, do a little of that. But I think CBT can be as profound or as shallow as we allow it to be. And I think the mindfulness pillar of CBT, I think can bring a real depth to it.
Yeah, and I noticed too that sometimes my own feeling with CBT, even though I'm training, is that sometimes I feel like it's a little kind of out there. And by that I mean that when I talk to people, sometimes I think I maybe don't get too deep into it because I think that depends on my feeling, I guess, that day, that some of the stuff sounds kind of and I don't know why I think this, but sometimes I feel like, oh, I wonder if this person's gonna think this is kind of hokey. But when
Oh no, yeah, I totally get that.
Oh, you do? Okay, because I was thinking, but I'm trained in this and I really believe in it. But sometimes I'm like, oh, this is going to sound really weird to the person.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it, so at least this is my fear at times that suggestions I give or techniques I teach a person from a CBT approach might seem kind of pat, like oh well that's it can't possibly be that simple, or yeah, well, that would work if not for these real issues in my life. Like, oh, well, how am I going to change my thoughts? I guess I'm just anticipating a lot of kind of not naysaying isn't quite the right word, but
I know what
sort
you
of
mean.
second, yeah. So I'm always impressed with people who do seem to take the concepts of CBT and really give them flesh and present them in a way that's just really easy for people to relate to and absorb and apply.
I think if you get out of it what you put into it too. So if you feel like this might work, that is maybe 50% of it that you're willing to try these concepts. And there's one car in particular that it actually caused me anxiety. So we'll talk about this. And it's a really good car because I think this is probably something I need to work on. So I'm very almost compulsive about being on time. And so I'll just let the listeners know that. So Michael's setting up all the tech stuff, and so I think I was like gonna be, I think I was 2 minutes before we were supposed to talk. And I'm emailing you, and I'm texting you on Skype going, I'm gonna be a little late. And I think we started talking what, like 2 minutes after the hour or something. So that's my thing about being on time. That's probably rooted somehow in ADHD and anxiety and a whole bunch of things. So there's one called Letting Go Worry About Time. It says the next time you're feeling stressed that you might be late for something, open yourself up to the possibility that you could indeed be late. And I went, oh, no. And
Yeah, tell me more. What was.
then it gets more kind of, so it could happen for any number of reasons. And I'm thinking, what could all those reasons be?
Let me find out what they are, and then I'll make sure they don't happen.
So then I'm starting thinking, well, what could happen? So that gets the anxiety going. But then you said, but it'll be whatever time it is when you arrive there. Kind of like, well, if you're running late, you just keep going to where you're supposed to go. And what do you need to focus on in the meantime? I thought, oh, well, that's brilliant. Because then I noticed, oh, I am having some anxiety about that. And then you kind of did a soothing reframe of it. That whatever time it is, that's gonna be where you're at. And it's a, you know, I, it reminds me that is it Thich Nhat Hanh that has that book, you know, Be Where You Are. It's kind of like, well, if you're gonna be late, just be present. And that was really powerful. But it was interesting how initially I was thinking, well, what do you mean I could be late?
I know. Yeah, that's definitely one that I need. I remember one time I was taking the train to a talk I was giving, and I didn't realize the trains were running late that day. So, I'm the way the streets run, I'm getting off of 34th, and I get on at, around 63rd is the first numbered street I ran into. So there I am, I'm counting down the streets, and I can see, I'm gonna get there after I get there. But I'm gonna, no, that would be amazing if I got there after I got there. No, I'm gonna get there,
That's a whole other CBT concept.
That's right. Yes, that involves five dimensions. No,
Maybe that's the third time we'll talk. We'll talk about that.
that's right. Actually, we already had that conversation, Stephanie,
Yeah,
but I
interdimensional.
that's right. But no, I was gonna get there after the time I was supposed to be. And so but I just kept monitoring the time, like what time is it gonna be now? What time is it gonna be now? And then I was learning about mindfulness at the time, and I thought, you know what? It's gonna be, I don't know if I had exactly, the thoughts that's on that card, but I realized like my monitoring the street number that we're at is not gonna make this train go any faster or slower. So do something else.
Yeah, I wonder how much of is it that our need for control, we're running late, that at least we can control reading the numbers, or I wonder if it's maybe a focusing technique that we unconsciously use. But that's also the other thing I think we talked about earlier was that before we recorded that the habit part of it. So how it, when you have kind of a compulsion or maybe I don't want to pathologize it, but you just have a tendency to want to be on time or punctuality is important to you. How do you start developing that as a habit? So if someone reads the card, how do you adhere to that when for 20, 30, 40 years you've had issue of getting extremely anxious when you're late. How do you start incorporating that and kind of changing things?
Yeah. But I think one thing to do would be to find the practices that could have the biggest impact on your life and prioritize those. I mean, if you go through the deck and there's some that stand out, you know, set those aside to come back to. Or maybe, you know, keep one. I mean, you don't have to use the cards to do this. You could just do it with the concepts or practices. But if you're using the cards, just, you know, keep practicing the same card for a while. But I mean, I think, as you know, that's so much about what CBT is. It's not this, it's not insights that nobody has had before. It's a system of, you know, implementing those insights into action. So, you know, we could tell someone to face your fears. Like, okay, there you go, problem solved. But not really, because it's not that easy.
Right.
So let's come up with a structured plan. Let's make consistent progress toward it. Let's break it down into manageable steps. Let's build an accountability so that you're more likely to follow through when it's difficult. Mm-hmm. Let's think about some of your beliefs that could lead you astray that we can challenge together. So it's I think like with any part of CBT, it is about that the repetition and the structure that goes around it.
Right. I think that structure is especially important, especially when you have anxiety. Having that, and I think the idea that you can carry these with you anywhere, or just carry one or two that are particularly salient, I think is a real bonus. I really like that about the decks, because I think this is one of the decks that I think there's a whole bunch of them out, I think. Well, I wouldn't say a whole bunch. I think I see
four or five.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, I think they're like maybe close to 30 now.
This is the first one I've seen on CBT, I think.
Yeah, this is their first CBT one.
Oh, cool. Okay, so that's what I was thinking. So I think this is a really nice, not only primer, but there are some cards that you can take as a primer, and then some cards you can do kind of a deep dive in CBT. And depending on your personality or what issues are coming up, just the simple one of take care of yourself. That's huge. I think that's one of the biggest things I see when I work with people, is that idea that your health needs to come first.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. And I do. I mean, I liked the idea of the cards, you know, making them portable, but, you know, until I use them myself, and again, this sounds so self-promotional, but, you know, I've got it here. It's right. You know, I can mm-hmm. bring it in my laptop case. I put it on my desk so I can refer to it. I keep it out when I'm at home, and just, you know, seeing that reminder, the little title at the top, you know, jogs my memory. Like, oh yeah, so let me look for an opportunity to do that. You know, I think it was a couple of days ago, listening with presence. Like, great. You know, obviously that's useful at work and also at home.
And that kind of leads me to another question. So I run into this sometimes, probably even with myself, I'm sure, but with clients that the CBT or thinking issue of all or nothing thinking, and people will say, well, I really want to practice CBT, so every day I'm going to try out a new CBT concept. And then I talk with them during a session, they say, well, you know, I didn't do it on Monday, so I just said forget it and didn't do it the rest of the week. How do you push through that kind of feeling of, you know, progress is progress, and even if you look at one card or you miss a day, that doesn't mean all is for naught. How would you talk to people about that in kind of a CBT way, that anytime you look at one of the cards, it helps you?
I mean, I it's a good question, because it does come up often, that kind of like, well, I missed one day, so what the heck, may as well just scrap it. You know, it happens with exercise and diet a lot as well.
Right.
So I think, you know, kind of, I don't know if inoculating is the right word, but preparing a person for that possibility. You know, if we know that someone's prone to all or nothing or black or white thinking, saying, you know, what's going to happen if you sort of fall off for one day? How are you going to get back on and build that into the plan? So there is a way to come back. I mean, the nice thing about being in therapy is that, you know, assuming you keep coming, you come back the next week, then you can talk about that and figure out a way together to not let that become such a barrier. But yeah, I think in general, there actually is a countering all or nothing thoughts card. for exactly that reason, because it comes up a lot. And so I think it's a lot of it is just kind of the practice and repetition of it, kind of recognizing that black or white thinking shows up in all kinds of ways. It shows up with difficult people thinking like this person is, you know, is always difficult. And they actually may not be. There may be times when they're fairly pleasant, but God knows the tough times stand out.
Right. Right. And I think that's a particularly salient concept in CBT, is that that's why CBT works in part, is because it points out that those things, those negative things, tend to stand out. Cause I think that evolutionary wise is just how we're wired. It can kind of feel odd, I think, to people to start doing some CBT concepts. But I tell people, you know, the brain, even if you don't believe something, the brain goes and runs with it. So if you say, I'm gonna have a great day today, or this person just is going through some stuff, it's not personal, you don't really have to believe it, but your brain goes, okay, why don't we just run with that? So I think that's always, that's fascinating, that you don't even really need to buy into it.
I know, isn't
consciously.
It? It's funny, our brains, I mean, they're smarter than we think, but also not as smart as we think.
Right.
I mean, we can, like you're saying, we can kind of trick them that way. I mean, I guess our brains are smart enough that they can trick themselves.
Oh, yeah, that's deep. Wow. I feel like taking another pause and just chew on that. But you brought up another thing about answering the what ifs. That if someone says, well, what if this happens? Well, let's go there. Let's answer that what if.
Yeah, and my CBT supervisor, my very first supervisor who taught me cognitive therapy was Rob DeRubis. And he really introduced that idea to me, to the group that he was supervising, that, you know, we'll ask these kinds of hypothetical questions. They're not really questions. They're more, if you're like, I'm afraid this is going to happen, like when you say, what if something happens? But when we turn it into a statement and say, well, or answer it, treat it like it's a real question, then we can come up with some solutions. Then I would, you know, this is how I would solve it. Kind of like when, you know, again, back to difficult people, if someone cuts us off in traffic and we think like, oh, why would they do that? We don't mean why would they do that. We'd say like, oh, they're such a jerk for doing that. But if we actually, again, treat it like a real question, say, well, why would they do that? Maybe they didn't see me. Maybe they're in a rush to get to the hospital. Maybe that they don't see as well as they maybe should when they're driving. Mm-hmm. So that can you know, sometimes change how we feel about something if we just take a second to consider a different way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Or what if? What's the worst that can happen? Which maybe you can help me with this clinically, because I'm CBT solution focused. So I tell people, well, what's going well. So when I say to people, what's the worst that can happen? It feels kind of therapeutically off, but it's a very valuable question. So it's interesting kind of trying to fit that together. Cause I had a client say, well, so you just told me like, when are things going well? But then you just told me to answer the what ifs, and that's stuff that's not good. I said, well, that's an excellent point. So, how do you balance those, that you want to be positive, but at the same time answering the what ifs?
Well, and what occurs to me is you can be very positive about a negative by saying, you know, worst case scenario, you use all the talents and skills and experience you have to solve that problem, even if it's a terrible problem. And that, I mean, that's to me like a pretty optimistic message. You know, that no matter what it is, that even if it's not okay, it's going to be okay.
Right. And I really like the quote of, I don't know who said this, but I dwell on possibilities. I think that's a really key feature of CBT, is it gives you options. It helps you come up with solutions. And maybe there's a solution you haven't even touched on yet, because we tend to get stuck in things.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually don't see, I mean, I can see how the two would seem to be in contradiction, but you're not teaching people to be Pollyannas, right? You're
right.
not saying,
yeah,
only
sure.
imagine everything goes well. Like. Mm-hmm. No, let's be realistic. And part of being solution focused is coming up with realistic solutions to potential problems.
That's true. Because there's a realistic part and also a what's in your best interest part too, that plays into that too. And it's not just a question of what's the worst that could happen. Well, let's come up with the best of the worst that could happen, I guess. that right. It actually is a positive question. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Thanks for kind of reframing that for me. Oh, and that brings up reframing. If you can explain to me what reframing is and how beneficial that is and how that relates to CBT.
Well, I mean, I see all kinds of types of reframing, mm-hmm. but you know, it's any different way of looking at a situation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess sort of in a concrete way, it's sort of like the content might be the same, but you put a different frame around it, and you know, like a painting, it might totally change the experience of the painting. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe this is one that I like. Almost any problem that we can experience, I think we can reframe as something good. So an example is I took my middle child, one of our daughters, to the emergency room one night a couple years ago, and it's, you know, as it usually is with these things, it was probably like midnight or something, and I'm thinking, I'm gonna be here for hours. I'm not mm-hmm. gonna get much sleep. Maybe I'm gonna get sick. And mm-hmm. We weren't too concerned about our daughter, but you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, she should probably be seen tonight. But I'm thinking, yeah, you know, concerned about her health. And then I realized, you know, I parked the car and I'm carrying her in. And I thought, there's a hospital 10 minutes from my house, maybe five mm-hmm. minutes. When it's midnight, there's no traffic. And it's open 24 hours, 365 days a mm-hmm. year. And there are people who are going to, you know, take care of my daughter, make sure she's okay. And all of a sudden I felt so much gratitude instead of feeling like, oh, you know, poor us, you know, poor me, having to have to come out in the middle of the night. What if this is, you know, not really an emergency? And you know, it turned out she was fine. It was such a different frame, same hospital, same time of mm-hmm. night, same daughter in my arms. And we had a great time together. Actually, that night we kind of had fun.
Really?
Yes.
Who would have thought?
I know.
That's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, same night, I think it was the same night. I've taken her to the ER a couple times, but we're, you know, I'm sitting there in her room and she was able to get some sleep, not her room, but you know, the little, mm-hmm. little, whatever, right. curtained off area. Right. And, so right away I thought, okay, you know, she's sleeping, nothing going on. Let me take out my phone, you know, read mm-hmm. the news, pass the time. And then I often do that. And it's not like I never on my phone or I'm always waiting with my hands free. But mm-hmm. but on this occasion I thought, well, let me just not and sort mm-hmm. of see what happens. And I was flooded with such gratitude for her. I mean, there she was. She's probably, you know, 5 or 6 at the mm-hmm. time, and she's, you know, sleeping peacefully with this right. kind of angelic face, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of face kids only have when they're sleeping mm-hmm. for the most part. And it's an experience I would not have had if I had just, you know, kind of reflexively taken out my phone and I would have never known. I wouldn't have known like, ah, yeah, but I missed out on that experience because mm-hmm. it wouldn't have happened.
Right. No, that's a really excellent point about the use of electronic devices. See what happens when you just put it down. We just talked about that earlier, but there's some really profound things that people experience when they put down their phone and look around them. Or I had one patient tell me, well, things are really green outside. I said, yeah, because when you're looking at your phone, it has this artificial green that you cannot replicate in nature. And it's a different kind of green outside. And it was really interesting. He said, for the first time, I'm really paying attention to the color differences. And and he just noticed that because he had been walking around with his phone so much.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, when we're on a screen, no matter, I mean, it brings the whole world to us, but I put that in quotes because really it's a screen. The scenery never really changes as long as we're, you know, looking at a gadget, but yeah, you lift up your eyes and you look, you know, you look above your screen and it's, there's just so much, like you said, colors mm-hmm. that you don't see, people, like right. actual three-dimensional right. people.
In real life, people, imagine that.
I know. I mean, and obviously, you know, technology has real pluses, like here you right. and I are, you know,
right,
I
mean, right.
you're in Florida, uh-huh. Florida, I'm in Pennsylvania, we're having this real-time conversation. Mm-hmm.
As you know, it digitizes and your voice drops out for a second.
right.
That was perfect timing.
Oh, yes, right, limitations.
Right. We'll reframe that and say, but You know, that you just wrapped up all of technology in one thing, because we talked about great technologies, but at the same time, it just dropped out. That is deep as well. We're talking a lot of profound things.
That's right.
So I was going to ask you, so for those of us that tend to be somatic, and I'm not naming names, but I'll just say it, me. So when I've taken someone to the emergency room, I think you said something like, I'm going to get sick. That's been my feeling too. And I'm wondering how CBT can help with that. Because I know that some of us, when we're anxious, we swing towards we're going to get sick, or, I have a headache, and, you know, I'm going to focus on that, and then it gets bigger. And what's a CBT-related way to stop that kind of somatic loop?
Well, I mean, I think, again, three things. I'll try to cover them quickly. One is, you know, recognize the thought, acknowledge the thought, and just by acknowledging that I just had the thought I could get sick, right? It shows us that it's not a truth about the world, right? Like, I'm going to get sick. That's, maybe you will, maybe you won't, but it's different from an observation like the leaves are green, right? Mm-hmm. That's something true about the world. So I might, okay, I'm having the thought I might get sick. Recognize the thought. Mm-hmm. Obviously, do what you can in terms of behavior to stay as healthy as possible. You know, maybe that's your brain's way of warning you. You know, wash your hands, get as much sleep. You know, maybe sleep in a little tomorrow if you can. Drink plenty of fluids, and then practice acceptance. You might. It's possible you get sick. Mm-hmm. And back to your question, what's the worst thing that'll happen? Well, what if I get sick and I have to take off from work? Then you'll take off from work. You'll have to use some of your sick days. Or if you're self-employed, you won't make money those days. You'll have to deal. Yeah. That'll be the world that you inhabit. Mm-hmm. But, and again, Stephanie, I wrestle with so much of this myself, kind of fighting against the world that is and thinking the world that I imagine is as it ought to be. So if I have in mind, like, I should have worked this many days, and I was, you know, projecting that I was going to work that many days, and I didn't expect this, and this is not how it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Like, it's as though the world that I imagine in my head is the. I mean, it's a forecast, right? It's like a meteorologist would make, but the meteorologist doesn't complain like, oh, the weather got it wrong yesterday. You know, I had the right forecast. Right? These are guesses.
That'd be interesting.
That'd be the magic weatherman, right?
I know. That would be interesting to watch sometimes. Some guys saying, well, you know, obviously I'm right in the situation. That'd be totally narcissistic.
Right.
I got it right. The weather, you know, the weather just doesn't pay attention to me. And it really should.
I mean, in our own, and again, totally include myself in this, our own kind of benignly narcissistic way, at least, you know, it's not the malignant toward others type of narcissism, but certainly not friendly to ourselves. We try to impose our own concepts of what the world should be on the world as it is. And it's never, I mean, sometimes it might line up just by chance, but not because we wished it.
Right. Right. And I also think of the thing of there's no bad events, just good stories. My thing is always, if I travel, I'm going to get sick. And it just so happened, I was in Baltimore, and there's some really nasty, I think it was a norovirus type thing. And so I'm giving 3 days of lectures to people, and it hits me in the middle of the lecture right around lunchtime. And this is 6 hours. Yeah, so you feel my pain. And I'm already...
It's a nightmare in a way, right?
Yeah,
it's like
exactly right. So I'm like thinking I'm going to die because, you know, my brain goes there because it was so painful. And I went to the ER, and I remember I didn't have a car, so I had to Uber to the ER. Went to urgent care. They said I was sick enough to go to the ER. And then I'm panicking because the doctor goes in and goes, you have an elevated white cell count. That is very, very bad. And I'm like, I'm all by myself in Baltimore. And I had to call the speaking, you know, the speaker's bureau and go, I'm really sick. And they're fine with it. You know, they're like, well, you know, you're thrown up. You can't do much about that. But it was the worst case scenario. And after that, it was kind of easy. So I'm texting Michael. I'm like, I think I might die. He's like, you're not going to die. Because he somehow did not wind up with anxiety, which is great. Right. He's like human Valium. He's like, you're fine. And he said, I'm going to get the first flight out. So he was there by like 8 a.m. the next morning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we wound up turning it into a trip. Of going to, he had never been to any of the museums in DC. So we spent, I think, 3 or 4 days going to all the museums, including the Air and Space Museum, because that's something we both really enjoy. And it, we turned into a vacation. Not only that, but the 11 warning signs of gaslighting went viral during that time. And I remember here I am, like, hooked up to this IV, thinking I'm going to die. And I said to the doctor, I go, I just went double viral. and she goes, what happened? And I go, look, I'm like, I went viral on Psychology Today, and right. I've got a virus. And I think at that point, I had just, my brain probably just totally checked out because I was dehydrated. But that's what I tell people. Like, it's the day I went double viral. So now right. it's kind of a fun kind of story. But at the time, I was like, this is my worst nightmare. But that's a way where you turn it into something different that I think that really saves us a lot of cases as we look at, like, what this could be a really good story later. And it actually has turned into one. So, and we got a trip to DC out of it. So
yeah, your worst case scenario turned into a nice mini vacation with your husband.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that too, that's that what if. Well, what if that happens? Well, you go to the ER. You know, there are doctor's places. I think someone else said something about wherever you're at, that's home. And I think that's a really decrease of anxiety too, is that you're home. There are always gonna be people that can help you. There's always somewhere you can go. Again, do the magic technology, you can talk to people anywhere. So I think that really helps too. But I was just thinking about that, is that that was my worst fear and it actually happened. So after that, it just doesn't seem so bad anymore. I'm like, well, you know, I'd rather not top that, but
right.
I've been there and it was okay.
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. So
it is funny that we have that kind of, that feeling of like what if, and if that, if happens, it's as though the world's going to end. Like, it's just a cliff. Like, that's right. It. Like, what if I lose my job? Like, that'll, and again, not, I don't think we think this explicitly, but like, it'll all be over. Like, I'll be done. Just like done, like running to the edge of the world. But then in reality, it's, then there's something next. There's always the next thing to do.
Right. Exactly. Again, that's that possibilities. Yeah. And it's never usually the way, if your worst fear happens, it's usually not the way you envisioned it at all, which is interesting. Nope. So you spend all this time, you know, in the rocking chair of worry, and you're faced with something that you didn't see coming anyway.
Exactly. Yep. It's never going to be that thing.
Right. Right. It's the stuff that happens like just on a random Tuesday at 4 p.m. But then that probably causes people anxiety. and then I talk about meta anxiety, that we can have anxiety about having anxiety.
Oh, yeah, that's so common.
Yeah. So how would CBT help with that? Because that's a tricky one.
Well, I mean, it definitely can be tricky, but I think, like anything else, you know, you practice facing it, practice opening to the possibility. You know, you might be anxious. Some of it, I think, is, you know, education can be helpful around it. That anxiety, in and of itself, isn't necessarily a bad thing. And, you know, learning through experience that we can do things even though we're anxious. And in fact, often doing things while we're anxious helps to decrease our anxiety. But even if it doesn't, at least it shows us that we don't have to feel 100% to do the things that are important to us.
Right. Exactly. I think that's very common with anxiety, is that things aren't going perfectly. So, or I'm not in this great space, so I'm not sure how I can even do this. And I think that stops people a lot from, when they have anxiety, that I'm not going to do it exactly how I want it to be. The perfectionistic thing kicks in.
Right. Yeah. I remember a time I was about to give a talk, and actually just a lecture, to, you know, regular weekly lecture to a psychology class. And suddenly I was gripped with anxiety. I just had this irrational feeling of, I can't go out there. I can't do this. But what was I going to do? It was time to teach. And so maybe partly from having had some of this training, I just thought, well, all right. I was going to take this anxiety in there with me. And, you know, seconds later, it was fine. But I think if we make being anxious the problem, then we're really fighting, you know, at least two fronts. We're dealing with whatever we're actually, maybe three, the task, our anxiety, and our anxiety about being anxious.
Yeah, that's really, yeah, that's true. How are we feeding into that anxiety? How are we making it a bigger kind of, I don't want to say monster, but a bigger thing than it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's another card I was going to ask you about. So that be your own friend. Cause I tell people, again, like I mentioned, you know, it's, you need to put your health first. And I say, it's kind of like on an airplane. They tell you to put your oxygen mask on before anybody else's. You got to practice good self-care. And I even tell women, I said, you know how you treat yourself when you're pregnant? you can do that even when you're not pregnant. You know, that you're a sacred vessel. You know,
yeah,
and that,
yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and I really like the card because it says, you know, when you make a mistake, treat yourself like you're someone you love dearly. Because why not? Why not treat yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and why wait until you're in acute pain to be nice to yourself? You know,
I
think of it like if you were, if you did have someone you really cared about, like a child, yeah, you know, you wouldn't wait until they're absolutely starving, you know, until they can't possibly, you know, hold their pee anymore to let them take a bathroom break. You know, it's like, oh, you got to go, do what you need to, you know, make life as free from suffering as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the other key piece, and that's that being part is that, you know, pain is inevitable, but suffering's optional.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that is so much of what the mindfulness is about, is letting go of unnecessary suffering.
Right. So, in closing, what's something you'd like to leave people with today about CBT, and particularly for dealing with difficult people or with anxiety?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, any small step that you can take toward dealing with either of those, I think, is valuable. So don't downplay the importance of even a small step in the direction you want to go. But I think, you know, our relationships are so important. And so if you do spend a lot of time around difficult people, you know, if you just have to, maybe a family member or a boss or coworker, then, you know, make sure you at least balance that out with time with people that you really care about, people that uplift you. That can certainly help with stress and anxiety as well. But for anxiety specifically, I think, I mean, as with difficult people, really, just accepting that there is going to be anxiety, you are going to feel anxious at times, and not making it worse than that. That it's, you know, anxiety in and of itself is much much less of a problem most of the time than the anxiety we have about it, or the resistance that we have about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Seth. I really appreciate it. And thanks for coming on the podcast again.
It's great to be back. I'm happy to talk with you anytime, Stephanie. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Talking Brains. This episode's guest was Dr. Seth Gillihan, the author of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Made Simple, 10 Strategies for Managing Anxiety, Depression, Anger, Panic, and Worry. He's also the creator of the CBT deck, 101 Practices to Improve Thoughts. You can find him at SethGillihan.com. That's SethGillihan.com. And I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Sarkis. Please hit subscribe and give us a rating. It's appreciated. I can be found at StephanieSarkis.com. Thank you.